Welcome to another episode of Spanish History 101, brought to you by Brian Spain Domain. We are now heading into the second half of the 16th century, and we will focus on one of the most important periods in Spanish history, Spain under Philip II, or Felipe II, his father, Charles V, Emperor Charles V, known as Charles I or Carlos I of Spain, died in 1558, but by then he had already transferred his powers to his son to be king of Spain. That was in 1556, and to his brother Fernando, who would become the Holy Roman Emperor. Now, Felipe was a little bit upset by that, at least that's what they say, but in the end, that was probably a better thing for him because, as we will see, he already had enough to deal with, let alone try to focus his time and his effort and his money on what was basically Germany back then and the German states, which was a very volatile situation anyway. Anyway, by that time, Felipe had already had a pretty interesting life. He was born in 1527 in Valladolid, in the city of Valladolid. His mother was Isabel of Portugal, but unfortunately she would not live for very long. She died just 10 years later. Felipe, at the age of 13, was named Duke of Milan, and then he became King of Naples a few years later, a title that would be given to him so that he could marry Mary Tudor, Mary the First of England, but we'll get to that in a second. But anyway, the point is, at this time, Felipe is being groomed to become the next king of Spain. And his father, Carlos, is impressed by the way his son can handle the responsibilities that are being handed down to him. Another thing that happens during this period is that Felipe gets married. We'll see that this happens many times. But he first marries a woman named Maria Manuela of Portugal, and she gives birth to their only son, Carlos, and she died just shortly after that. She was actually Felipe's cousin. This was pretty common back then. In fact, when they married, they went to see and pay their respects to Juana I, known informally as Juana la Loca, Juana the Crazy, the Mad, though she wasn't. And that was in the town of Tordesillas. And they did that because she was actually the grandmother of both. Anyway, Carlos, after his mother died, would be raised by his aunts, especially, and obviously the servants naturally. But he would end up having a troubled youth, and he would be a troubled kid for much of his short life. And Felipe, during this period, in addition to tending to his responsibilities, his duties as prince and future king, also looked for a second wife, and he set his aims on Mary, that is Mary Tudor, daughter of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. Catherine would have been Felipe's great aunt, and so Mary was a distant cousin, but a distant enough cousin. But that really wasn't the odd part about it, and this was sort of a strange marriage from the beginning. They were both fervent Catholics, so that was one thing they had in common. Mary had briefly restored Catholicism to England and was searching for a father, for a future heir that would prevent her half-sister, Elizabeth, from becoming the next monarch. If you recall, Henry VIII had separated from the church, the Catholic Church, and had created the Church of England. Anyway, Felipe saw a lot of political and strategic pros to marrying Mary and becoming ruler of England. But Mary's Spanish choice was widely unpopular, in part because he was Catholic and they feared what would happen in the future, and also because he was Spanish, therefore not English, and they didn't know what would happen to England if she died before he did. And so, to make a long story short, he could only be king of England as long as she was alive, and he couldn't make use of English resources, especially the military, for his own aims. On top of that, more modifications had to be made before the wedding could go through. As I told you, Felipe at the time was only a prince and a Duke of Milan, but that was not good enough. So Felipe's father, Carlos renounced his place as king of Naples so that his son could take over as the king and thus make him eligible for marriage with the queen. Anyway, the union was a failure on all levels. Basically, she probably had a thing for him, was in love with him, but chances are he wasn't particularly attracted to her. Mary faked a pregnancy. In fact, that may be too strong. She quite possibly had convinced herself that she was pregnant, although she was getting on, but nothing happened. No pregnancy developed, and she died just a few years later in 1558, childless. So Felipe returned to Spain, widowed for a second time, but he would employ a totally new strategy to deal with England later on, as we shall see. Now, sticking to his marriages and his issues, that is, his children, Felipe, still young and apparently very concerned about the stability and rulability of his son, Carlos, went for a third wife. This time, he went in a totally different direction. Instead of someone aging like Mary, he opted for a barely pubescent French girl named Elizabeth, or Isabel, of Valois, who was just 14 at the time of their marriage. She was actually supposed to marry Felipe's son, Carlos, but given the need for an heir, he decided to take her for himself. And this was a result, in part, of a peace treaty known as the Treaty of Cateau-Cambrésis in 1559, which ended the Italian Wars. These were wars which had been going on for years and years. But anyway, amid all the decisions that were agreed upon in the treaty, a couple of royal marriages were sort of sneaked in there, and that explains that. Still, sort of tough to fathom these things from a modern perspective, but that's the way things work quite often. Anyway, the two had two surviving daughters, but Isabel herself died in 1568 while giving birth. On top of that, a few months before that, his only male son, Carlos, had died under somewhat controversial circumstances. I talked at length about this in a different podcast some time back. In any event, male heirs were the preference of the day, so he moved on and found a fourth wife, Anna of Austria. Anna was at least a more respectable age. She was 21, he was 42, but at least she was overage, so to speak. And the only thing that was a bit unusual about this is that Felipe was her uncle. They would have three boys, Fernando, who died at the age of 7, Diego, who died at the age of 7, too, and then finally Felipe, who went on to become the next king. So it took four marriages and about 10 pregnancies for his goal of a male heir to be achieved. Anna died in 1580, I believe, and he never remarried. Anyway, focusing on his tenure as a king, Felipe reigned at a time when Spain was arguably at the height of its power, quite possibly not its biggest as a territorial empire, but at the height of its power. He was named king in 1556, and one of the first things he did was establish a permanent capital, which was sort of a break from the traditional medieval custom of the king or the monarch moving the court around from city to city in the kingdom. And he chose Madrid, and this took place in 1561. And with the exception of a brief period when it moved back to Valladolid for a few years, it has been that way ever since. Now, some people are surprised to learn that Madrid began to take center stage in this country at such a late date. And that's understandable. The main urban centers for many years were Toledo, Segovia, Burgos, and Valladolid, to name just a few. Madrid was an important town, but it wasn't a major city, which is quite possibly why Felipe chose it to begin with. There was no competing noble class, no cathedral, giving the church a weaker presence. It was also ideally located, and despite having sort of an unbecoming river for a capital, sort of the feeble Manzanares River, it was better than nothing, and there was also quite a bit of underground water. much more than people realize. In fact, you'd sort of think that this city was built on water. There actually exists a subterranean reservoir with an area of about 1,000 square miles, which is more than four times the size of the city itself. Anyway, Madrid was not sort of the true final place that Felipe had in mind for his court. Just 2 years later, he broke the ground for the massive El Escorial Monastery Palace to be built. This is outside of Madrid. If we take a car today, it's about a 45-minute drive west-northwest of Madrid. This is one of the most extraordinary buildings ever erected in Spain, if only for its uniqueness. And it's one of the biggest buildings constructed at that time. By today's standards, I guess we could say it was sort of a multifunctional structure, a palace, a royal residence, a monastery, a library, a church. It's even become a school. And it's also the final resting place for most Spanish monarchs since that period. Its appearance is striking, if not imposing. Felipe's instructions to his advisors were clear and simple, directing the architects to produce simplicity in the construction, severity in the whole, nobility without arrogance, and majesty without ostentation. And boy, did they nail it. Some people are sort of turned off by El Escorial, saying it's a little bit too austere, a little bit too simple, a little bit too plain. But I think they are expecting something more in tune with, like, maybe Versailles. And that wouldn't make any sense because that's a totally different period, and it wouldn't have sort of jived with Felipe's mindset. I highly recommend you see it if you've never been there. Under Felipe II, Spain's economy sort of struggled. Unfortunately for Felipe, he inherited a lot of debt from his father, and I mean a lot. Charles V was constantly enmeshed in wars throughout Europe, and Spain under Felipe would default on its loans numerous times. For the most part, it wasn't his fault, but he somehow wasn't able to bring it under control the way he would have liked. Money was coming in to the country from the Americas, but much of it was misspent or could hardly cover things like the interest accrued on the loans. And on top of that, Spain's decentralized government made making a coherent economic policy next to impossible. Remember, we are talking about different kingdoms. It's not just one kingdom. They're different kingdoms with one ruler. This is something that would hamper Spain in this department for a very long time. Felipe had to deal with a lot of other issues abroad, both in Europe and further beyond. On the old continent, Spain's occupation of the Low Countries, or sort of like the Netherlands, but it's also Belgium and places like that, would turn out to become what some scholars have called Spain's Vietnam. That is a no-win situation. This is sort of an interesting part of Spain's history as an empire, because the Low Countries were kind of an oddball part of Spain. How and why did that ever come to be? It seems so random, but Spain never really invaded the Netherlands. It was acquired, I'll put it that way, through inheritance, practically. Felipe's grandfather, Felipe the Handsome, was from there. When his grandmother, Juana of Castile, married him, his lands were passed on to their son, Carlos, or Charles V, and then Carlos passed it on to Felipe. Now, from a commercial standpoint, it seemed like a very advantageous territory for Spain, but in practical terms, it was a mess. And why was that? Well, for one, the Dutch wanted nothing to do with the Spanish, and they really had nothing to do with them. They were very different cultures with different histories. There was just no feeling between the two. The other factor was religion. While his father, Carlos, was a little bit more lenient with Protestantism, Felipe was, as I said, a fervent, diehard Catholic with a mission to unify the church once again and bring what he thought was harmony to the universe. This attitude, along with heavy taxing, simply ticked the Dutch off even more. Rebellions were frequent. The official moment when the Dutch tried to get rid of the Spanish started in 1568, but it would take more or less 80 years for that to complete. Felipe had sent a man known as the Duque, the Duke of Alba, to bring things under control. The Duke proved to be so ruthless in his repression of the Protestants that it bordered on what some say pathological. To this day, the Dutch recall him with utter disdain. Even Felipe realized that this was not the best route to take and had him replaced. The conflict continued, but for the moment, the Spanish managed to bring things under tense control, thanks in part to the fact that the Spanish had sort of the finest standing army of the day, led by the feared military division known as the Tercios, Tercios. They were the fiercest fighting machine of the time. The Dutch actually sort of declared independence from Spain in 1581, but it would be a long time before they could see that through. Now, another front that not only Spain but the rest of Europe had to contend with was the threat of the Ottomans in what was now Turkey, and they had spread and moved west. They were slowly but surely encroaching on different kingdoms. And so in 1571, the Pope called for the formation of a Holy League to combat the Ottomans, and the Spanish soundly defeated them at the Battle of Lepanto. Future celebrities in literature of the likes of Miguel de Cervantes fought in that battle and was actually wounded three times. So Felipe enjoyed naval success there, but unfortunately for him, he would go down in history for a military disaster known as the Spanish Armada of 1588. This operation was a complex mission from the beginning, almost foolhardy, and little suggested that it would be a success. To begin with, the commanding officer, the Duke of Medina Sidonia, had no experience in these matters, and he told the king that much. He was sorely underqualified for the post, but Felipe chose him anyway. The loss has gone down in history as historic, but most people don't realize was that the war would go on for many more years and the British would suffer their own setbacks. But anyway, today that's what people know about and have heard about, and it certainly was a serious setback for Spain. And what makes this episode even more unusual is that if you recall, Felipe was king of England just 30 years before that, and that's something that a lot of people don't know about. Another major change was what they called the Iberian Union, which took place in 1580 when Spain and Portugal became one. Now, this really wasn't the unification, a unification. Portugal functioned mainly as an independent country, but the two had the same ruler. Still, for many years there, it seemed as if this golden dream of a unified peninsula would actually come true one day. So that was going on there. So it was a pretty busy time and a busy reign for this man. Felipe was also a very cultured man and a fine collector of the arts, as well as a patron of the arts. Some of the finest painters of his day produced work in his court or for his court, such as the Italian painter Titian, who spent the final decades of his life essentially working for Felipe. Spanish literature was about to reach its apex in universal literature, thanks to a handful of fantastic writers. This is a period known as the Siglo de Oro, or the Golden Century, or the Golden Age. Writers like Quevedo, Góngora, Lope de Rueda ignited the imagination. And of course, a little-known writer who would be on the verge of blowing down the doors of a genre known as the novel. His name was Miguel de Cervantes. and his book Don Quixote was underway. It wasn't published under Felipe II's reign, but it was getting close. So in Spain, there was a lot happening. The first school of mathematics in history was founded in 1583. The first world championship of chess was held in El Escorial. And the first winner was a Spaniard named Ruy López. He still exists in modern chess. The Ruy López opening in chess is one of the most famous and most popular openings to this day. So this golden age would get started for much of the reign of Felipe II and continue to flourish throughout much of the 17th century. The reign of Felipe II was one of the most important in the history of the country, mainly because it coincided with the height of its power as a nation. And Felipe was an intelligent man and in certain ways a capable leader. He was known as El Prudente, the cautious, Felipe the Cautious, which in certain ways can be a virtue, but in other ways can turn out to be a detriment. The thing was, he was hindered by a couple of potential weaknesses. One was his excessive religious fervor, which influenced his policies in many areas in ways which proved detrimental to Spain's interest. And he was also probably too much of a hands-on ruler. He is said to have gotten bogged down with details and wasn't particularly good at delegating. That showed interest on his part as a ruler, but considering the outrageously large size of his empire at the time, it was also probably very impractical. And the fact that he had to contend with different kingdoms in Spain, with different interests, complicated matters even more. So he was a very interesting figure, and the more I research his life, the more I am fascinated by it. At the end of his reign, Spain was still a major power with many years of greatness ahead, but in other ways, it was probably slightly weaker than at the beginning of his reign, and its position was slowly giving way to other rising powers like the English, the French, and the Dutch. Felipe died in 1598, and he leaves us with a legacy that we can view to this day. Spain, as a major power and major cultural force, will continue, but things will begin to slow down. In the next century will be led by the three, what they called, lesser Habsburg kings, and we'll look at them in the next episode. And that'll be all for this episode of Spanish History 101. There was a lot to talk about, but we hope you've enjoyed it. Please leave us any comments or questions. We love the feedback. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and Castos. Or if you wish to support Brian's Spain Domain, we'd greatly appreciate it. We work very hard to provide you with the best information about Spain, Spanish history, Spanish culture. And you can do so by clicking on our PayPal donate button. Or if you want, you can have access to absolutely all of our podcasts and support us regularly by checking us out on Patreon at the link provided below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.